Amid all the carbon dioxide issued by world leaders following the climate change agreement over the weekend, how strict will the new rules be? From Marketplace, I'm David Brancaccio. All countries will now have to publicize and stick to plans to cut the emissions of gases linked to climate change. That's the essential result of the UN's Climate Change Summit that concluded this weekend in Paris. But do they really have to stick to this? Marketplace's European correspondent Stephen Beard is here with more. Morning to you, Stephen.
Hello, David.
So people have had a few days to digest this agreement now. For those hoping this deal actually works as intended, should we ruin the party by mentioning that it's not all that binding?
Well, it's partly binding. I mean, once the signatory countries ratify it, there's a big question about that happening in the US, but if they do, it becomes overall binding on them. But there's a lot of voluntary stuff in this agreement. Countries, for example, can decide how much they're going to cut their own emissions. And the precise level of financial aid that each country gives to the developing world is also voluntary. Critics say this is a major weakness, but supporters, like Britain's climate change and energy minister Amber Rudd, say it's not perfect, but in a world of sovereign nation states, it's the best we could hope for.
What we've got is the political will here. The countries have agreed to do this. They have to come forward with the proposals. And what you saw at the conference over the past few weeks was the support from civil society, from NGOs, and critically from businesses who are going to help to pay for this.
But none of this is free. There's the issue of cost, ongoing and with large numbers.
Businesses, consumers and taxpayers will have to pay for this. And it isn't going to be easy. I mean, the world currently emits some 46 billion tons of greenhouse gases. The plan under this deal is to reduce that to almost zero within the next 50 years.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you for this.
Thank you, David.
We'll also be carefully following the corporate debt market today. Junk bond funds could be in for a further rough ride ahead of the Federal Reserve's decision on interest rates on Wednesday. In an extraordinary move last week, one junk bond investment fund, Third Avenue Management, froze redemptions, meaning it stopped investors from cashing out. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the CEO there is out. Many investors had turned to high yield or junk bonds looking for some kind of return when ambient interest rates were so low for so long. Today is peak mail day, M-A-I-L, as in the busiest mailing day of the year for cards, letters, packages. That's according to the U.S. Postal Service. In recent years, the USPS has struggled with massive changes in the way we send mail. This accounting year, the Postal Service recorded a $5 billion loss. Marketplace's Noel King reports.
The Postal Service makes most of its revenue, around $30 billion in 2014, from first-class mail. Rick Geddes is a professor in the Department of Policy Analysis and Management at Cornell.
The volume of first-class mail peaked out in 2001 and has been declining ever since, and now I think it's declined by well over one-third.
Fewer letters are being sent, but more parcels are because of online shopping. This year, the Postal Service projects it will deliver 600 million packages between Thanksgiving and New Year's Eve. And parcels are a different ballgame than letters. John Callen is managing director of Ursa Major Associates, a postal and parcel consultancy.
Even if you think about your mailbox, it's one thing for putting a fistful of letters into a mailbox. If you got to put a parcel in there or take it to the front door, that's a higher cost.
From the mailbox, where parcels often don't fit, to the front door, then back to the post office if there's no one home, it's just more hours logged. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Now to America's immigration courts, bogged down with huge backlogs. Here's the number. About 500,000 cases are stuck waiting. And on average, according to research done at Syracuse University, those cases can take up to 2 years to resolve. Today, let's take a ground-level view, the observations of a former judge who's decided cases in Miami, Boston, and Chicago.
I'm Eliza Klein. I was an immigration judge for slightly more than 20 years, and I retired in January of this year. And now I'm working representing people in immigration proceedings. So starting in the spring of 2014, I started seeing cases on my detained docket of kids, 18, 19-year-old kids who had been detained crossing the border from Central America, and they were trying to get an asylum hearing. I didn't think it was right that the people were detained to begin with. I had a very difficult time justifying that to them. These were kids who were fleeing violence and themselves had not harmed anybody. And I didn't want to send them back. I didn't want to have to sign those orders. I had a young man who was about 18 or 19 from Honduras who was stopped crossing the border and detained. And the asylum office denied his initial credible fear request. And when he came to see me, I was telling him that I had to affirm the decision of the asylum office and he would be sent back. And he was crying and saying, I don't understand, you know, why do I have to stay in custody? I've never harmed anybody. And I said, you know, I can't justify it, but this is what the law requires. And, you know, I did not feel that it was the right thing to do morally to send that kid back to Honduras. But legally, that's what was required. You know, the few cases where you have to send somebody back, those are the ones you're going to worry about for the rest of your life. I retired when I could. It was earlier than I had anticipated, about 3.5 years early. And it was really because I no longer wanted to be part of the system. You know, it's a very significant responsibility, the decisions that immigration judges make. I'm glad I did have that responsibility, but I'm glad I no longer do.
Eliza Klein, an immigration judge for 2 decades. That was produced by Caitlin Esch of Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty team. From studios at Montclair State University in New Jersey, today I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report. From APM, American Public Media.